Welcome to Conversations with Leaders on Tremendous Life Radio, providing some of today's most influential and inspiring leaders a platform to share their stories of growing up, what happened, and what they're doing today. Now, here's your host, Todd Weaver.
Tonight, we've been looking forward to this guest for quite some time. Tonight, we have Mr. Bruce Van Horn. Bruce is a father, life coach, keynote speaker, marathon runner, entrepreneur, cancer survivor, and best-selling author. He's walking and talking proof that you can change your life by changing your thoughts. Bruce, welcome to Tremendous Life Radio.
Todd, it is such a pleasure. I've been a longtime fan of your show and love the cast that you've had through the years. And so it's a huge honor for me to be included in the all-star lineup you've had. So thank you, sir.
Well, and thank you for that, Bruce. It truly is our pleasure. We only have so much time. We want to get to know you, man. Take us back, if you would, to, you know, some early memories of growing up. Where are you from and what was going on early?
Sure. I have lived almost all of my life in Richmond, Virginia, which is where I am now. I was originally born in Dayton, Ohio. And between Ohio and moving to Virginia when I was 7, we actually moved 6 times. Wow. So, we bounced around a lot in my early years, but sort of settled here in Virginia, and it's been home. And, it's where I'm raising my boys. It's where I went to high school. I didn't go to college here, but, it's just a fun place for us to live. We enjoy it. As of right now, we are officially in summer. It is very warm here today.
Yeah, we were talking a little before the show about the heat in the East. Yeah. What about, are you an only child? Did you have brothers and sisters? What was that like early?
I am a middle boy. My parents have 3 sons, and so I have an older brother and a younger brother, and neither of them stayed here in Richmond, so it's kind of funny. So I'm here with my parents, and it's been fun. You asked me just a little bit about my childhood, and I grew up in just your average middle-class American family. My mom and dad just recently celebrated their 54th wedding anniversary.
Nice.
Well, we were never wealthy by any standard. We were just average Joe and Jane, American family. We never really wanted for anything. We never had anything really fancy, big houses or fancy cars, but we were just, the typical stable family. And, so I went off into high school and, did well academically. I was never a National Honor Society student, but somewhere along the line, and I can remember a couple things that were, I don't know if they were very traumatic in the scheme of what, other people have experienced, but, I made a fool of myself on like one of my first dates. And so that made me immediately shy around girls. I had a cross country coach who just did not believe that I would ever be successful at anything. And, a couple of those things happened. Plus I was slow developing. I was a very small guy. It's funny because both of my boys are already larger than I was when I was 16 years old. I was 5'1", 115 pounds when I was 16. I'm larger than that now. I grew, but I somehow or another, I developed a very poor self-esteem. Mm-hmm. And I carried that with me into college. And, but I discovered writing And so all I really ever wanted to be, you know, from really about my junior year in high school all through college was a writer. And you know, so I went off to college. I got a degree in English creative writing. I won several national writing awards and really had a very promising career ahead of me as a writer. So what does a guy do who, you know, has all he wants to ever be is a writer, and he's done well, and, you know, writing professors are, you know, are saying, you know, that you've got a future at this. So what does a guy like that do when he graduates from college?
Yeah, I don't know. I that to
work, well, the logical answer is that you go to work in sales for IBM, right?
Yeah.
that's what I did. You know, so it was a funny thing.
Bruce, if I may
interrupt.
Yeah, I'm gonna actually. I just did that. I want to. It never ceases to amaze me. It blows my mind, really. And as you were describing that, and then you got into the introvertedness, that not quite right with yourself phase. And I wanted to ask you, when you're growing up with two brothers, and you know, finding yourself, working things out, there was, I don't know if you knew it at the time, or maybe even looking back, maybe you didn't do this, but kind of were you keeping score, like you know, comparing yourself to others in that trap?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's a huge, you know, or a wonderful insight into the segue of where I was going to go with it. But, you know, there was something interesting about my life in high school and even in college, even though I was very shy and introverted, didn't date very much. I was never the socialite. I was the guy who, you know, certainly all of my close friends, but people who, you know, I was really just acquainted with, I seemed to always be the guy that people came to talk about their problems. And so it was like I was a counselor at a very young age. And so it's very interesting now, you know, within the last 4 years specifically, to have evolved into a life coach, because I'm doing now and getting paid for what I was doing in high school. And you know, and it's funny how these things sort of come around full circle, isn't it?
It is wild. And that, you know, that speaks of your, I don't know, it speaks of your demeanor, I guess. People felt safe enough to come to you with things. But even do you find it that even looking back then, inventorying those things from years before, I'm not sure you were really aware of what was going on in those years, maybe high school and college years. We're not really aware of what's going on inside of us. And it's just, I think that's one of the values of the show and telling our stories is people that are listening maybe can, you know, that they can relate to those kind of feelings and maybe become aware of what's going on with them maybe sooner than you or I did. Do you find that?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I talk about this a little bit. I've just written a book, but I was never a big fan of history. My 18-year-old son, my goodness, since the time he could read at, you know, 3.5, 4 years old, has always been fascinated with history. And he could tell you all the world events from any era. It's just something that he eats up. And it's not until recently that I've started to appreciate history, not on a world basis, but looking back over our own individual lives, you know, because our lives, as you said, things don't very often make sense to us as we're experiencing the events of our lives. But, you know, when you get a couple years on us, like we do, we can look back over our lives and go, oh, yeah, that thing that happened when you were 16, that thing that happened when you were 20, you know, those painful experiences that really sucked at the time, you know, the breakups or the confusions, the decision that you wished you hadn't made, you can see how all of those things really come into perfect alignment to have created the person that you are today. And without those things, you may not have met the person or gained the insight or the experience that launched you into whatever it is that you're doing now. And so it's well, and I guess fun for me to. Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry about that. That happens from time to time. It's radio, you know. It's just that what you're talking about. It is the, you know, the awareness piece. But you know, looking back on those times, I mean, you weren't really aware of what was going on. Looking back now, can you see how maybe in those inferiority years, maybe when you weren't so right with yourself, do you have any? Can you remember what it was you were telling yourself, or what kind of conversation was going on in your head?
Oh, sure. I had a cross country coach who, in my first, the one thing that I did do and did do fairly well while I was in high school was I was a runner. Yeah, I was not the best on our team, but I was pretty good. And we had in the first couple years a phenomenal cross country coach. He was really, really good. And then in my junior, I guess midway through the season of my junior year in high school, that coach took a job with another school, and he left us in the middle of the season. It was crazy. but I mean, I understand. But, you know, so when there's nobody, you can't hire a cross-country coach midterm. So, you know, who takes over but the overweight, cigar-smoking football coach? Who doesn't know anything about long distance runners,
right?
You know, and so anyway, I had a particularly bad race one day, and you know, in the world of cross country, if you're not in the top seven in your team, it doesn't really matter. You know, because the only points that get scored are the top seven of a team, and I already knew from my positioning that I was not in my own team's top seven, and I was not feeling well. And so I made a decision to just step off of the course and disqualify myself. And I just walked back. And, you know, so when I got back, the coach said, you know, "And what happened to you, Van Horn?" And I said, "Well, I just wasn't feeling well. So I just dropped out of the race." And he said, "You're a quitter. You're a loser. Uh-huh. You'll never amount to anything in life." And he said that in front of all of my teammates. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so at the time, but it did hurt my feelings. I won't, but I had not a lot of respect for the guy. So I didn't think it sunk in that deep. But as I experienced future failures, that what I, you know, what the world and then what I would have called failures at the time, the voice in my head started saying, "Oh, yeah. Maybe Coach Crowder's right. Maybe you are a quitter. You know, maybe you won't amount to anything in life. So why bother trying?" And so those were the voices, you know. And so, you know, one little fiasco that happened, you know, I was my very first dance, formal. I went to a military academy, and so everything is very formal. And so, you know, we went to a formal dance. And going down the stairs, I happened to, we were going up the stairs, and there was this, you know, gorgeous girl from our sister school. I think she was head of the cheerleaders. Everybody knew her. She was coming down the stairs, and I guess I wasn't paying attention. And I stepped on the back of my date's dress, and it tore her dress. Not a huge tear, but just a little tear. And the girl coming down the stairs saw me do that and laughed at me and said, "You're such a jerk." Oh. And so those little tiny things stuck with me. Mm-hmm. And you know, so, you know, and I think everybody has that experience. It's part of the just human experience that you do something that, you know, the rest of the world mocks you for, and we tend to own that. So we play those voices over and over in our heads, and you know, so it's not that we were ever born with a low self-esteem. It's that we sort of taught ourselves to listen to those voices that, you know, that just aren't true.
You know, Bruce, I look back and some of those voices that, or those lessons that I thought I was taught, I can see today that I wasn't even being taught those things. Those people didn't even say those things exactly. I just kind of heard them that way. And I guess I was fertile soil for that kind of thing way back. So I'll own my part in all those. And I find it interesting. Thank you so much for sharing some of those things. Sometimes we say it's those little things, and those things maybe could be very, very huge. You know, even from people that love us, that could be a whole different show, you know. But or you might have quit. I might not be talking to you right now if you would have believed all that stuff. So anyway, now you got out of college and you said, so you went on to IBM. Logical thing for a writer to do, right?
Right. Well, almost sort of, maybe kind of, you know, I'm 51. And so I graduated from high school in 1982. I graduated from college in 86 and in the world in the early 1980s that a writer would be particularly interested in. And that was the birth of the personal computer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I was an English major, and there's a really good reason that they keep the English majors on one side of the campus and the computer science majors on a completely different side of the campus, because we have nothing in common. But when the personal computer came out, and I heard that there was something called word processing. Oh my goodness. You know, these days our kids go off to school with shiny new laptops and iPads. And when you and I went off to college, my goodness, we went off with a shiny new typewriter, maybe, was our graduation from high school gift. And so our kids have no idea of what a typewriter is, and having to write papers, you know, and have whiteout and back it up and, you know, correct spelling mistakes. But when I learned that I could correct spelling, that I could, you know, move paragraphs or sentences around, I became enamored with the personal computer. And I really did. It came to me very, very naturally. And while I never once took a computer class, the college created a course called Introduction to Personal Computers. And it taught things like word processing, spreadsheets, and stuff like that. But I wound up becoming the student aide to the professor who taught that course, because it all just came naturally to me. So I wound up tutoring his students, because I started teaching all of my other English major buddies how to do this, because I saw how easy it made my writing life. And so I wanted everyone to share that same experience. And because I had a natural aptitude for writing and communication and a natural aptitude for the computers at that point, this professor had a contact at IBM, and they offered me a job in sales right out of college. So there was a little bit of symmetry there.
But, nice. And I want to clear something up, what you said, by the way. And you know, you said in the 80s when we were graduating college, in the 80s, I was living in the park, Bruce. So, you know, I mean, my story's a little different than yours. Yes, IBM wasn't IBM wasn't courting me at all. So, you know, anyway, please go ahead. So you started at IBM, and that was cool the way the timing worked for you.
It was. And I, you know, one thing that'll be important, you know, at least for my story, is that I did go to work for IBM, and I did well. I did very well, actually, probably too well, because I went from low self-esteem to super overinflated ego, because I was outselling people who had been there for 20 years. Mm-hmm. And the whole sales motivation thing, in big corporations, is often money motivated. You know, go out and sell because, you know, don't you want the big house and the fancy car and these nice things? And so I bought into that. Mm-hmm. And so I was very materialistic, and I really bought into, unfortunately, what seems to be the typical American dream, is that happiness really can only be attained through material acquisition. And so it was all about making money. It was all about the next car, the next house upgrade. And I had a friend talk me into starting my own company, and I had an ego the size of a nice house. And so I did, and I did not take some really good advice, and I took some additional really bad advice. And 2 years later, I was sitting in federal bankruptcy court, having lost it all, having had my super nice car repossessed, and now living back in an apartment. And so that was a major blow to
a little,
me. And so that
a little
I was 20.
A little right sizing going on, right? You got a little right size.
Exactly.
There. Did you know what was going on in those ego inflated years? Speaking of those kind of things, it just interests me. Did you have an inkling that maybe you were, did you know you were maybe a little bigger than you really were, or you never really took time to look?
Well, I knew that I had taken some bad advice. I did not really realize at the time that it was ego and my desire to make as much money as fast as I possibly could. I had not really, although I had some people tell me that to my face, I did not believe it. You know, I didn't think that there was anything wrong with that. You know, it was, you know, so, sort of like the Gordon Gekko on Wall Street. What's wrong with being rich kind of idea. So that was a big blow to my ego. I also had a lot of marriage problems. I got married, young to a girl that I had known, you know, most of my life. And while this show doesn't need to be about that, it is important that, you know, that I got married for all the wrong reasons, because I was looking for somebody else to make me feel loved, completed, satisfied. And there were always a lot of warning signals, but as it turns out, she had, and we are now divorced, but she battled severe schizophrenia. And so in counseling terms, ours was really a match made in heaven, because she really needed somebody to take care of, and I needed to be somebody's hero. And so I got a lot of emotional strokes from being, you know, the loving, taking care of her, you know, trying to find, we didn't know that it was schizophrenia at the time, because her particular form of it manifested itself physically. And but anyway, so there were all of those problems. We gave birth to a son who was awesome, and then when he was three, we gave birth to our daughter, and that was a life-changing event. Our daughter passed away after 8 days, and over $1 million worth of medical expenses. And so that really kicked me on my butt too. And you know, we weren't sufficiently insured to handle $1 million worth of medical expenses, and so I wound up again with hundreds of thousands of dollars of medical debt, and wound up filing bankruptcy again. And so by this point, you know, I never really got back to the, you know, the financial success I had originally. Everything was a struggle after my first bankruptcy, and largely because of the voices in, you know, inside my own head, sort of my own schizophrenia. That, you know, I'll never be good enough. You know, you made that huge mistake. You took that wrong advice. And, you know, I had fleeting glimpses of success, but it really disappeared very quickly. And I realize now the self-sabotaging that I did along the way.
And Bruce, so I gotta ask you, let me ask you, right, please. Excuse me. I about those little things, like maybe that overweight coach with the cigar. You know, even as your story's unfolding, I recognize that voice came back, and maybe it wasn't so little, you know. Absolutely. So, I mean,
it became huge.
Yeah. I want to ask you, because it intrigues me about that self-talk. It really does. But you know, during those times of change, where were you spiritually? Or were you seeking counsel? Were you reading books? Were you meditating? Were you reading in the morning? Were you being positive? Were you helping other people? Or were you just chasing and chasing?
Oh, I absolutely was not helping other people. You know, I am a Christian. I had a conversion experience when I was 27, actually in the midst of a major mental crisis with my wife. And it was real. It was transformative. But it wasn't along the lines of sort of the awakening that I've had within the last, you know, six, you know, almost 10 years of my life recently. But yes, I did find great comfort in church, and in spiritual things. But as I look even to those early days, it was me looking, you know, and yeah, it was still me looking outside for something to fix what was missing inside me. And that's a little difficult to unpack, but right. But yeah, it still was. While the conversion was real, my faith in God was absolutely real and continues to be real. It didn't really come crashing down into my life what it really was supposed to have been until recently.
I appreciate your candor on that, Bruce. I mean, that was like a super personal question, you know, and I think there's a lot of value in that. And that's why, you know, for listeners, that's why I asked that question. So even though you had a faith that you're doing the best you can with it, we don't really know ever at the time. So something was still a little amiss. You can tell us that now, but you couldn't have told us that then probably.
Yeah, you know, and so a lot of people, you know, they jump into religion as, you know, and I'll call it that. I'll call it religion. I'll call it churchianity rather than a real faith, a real relationship, or a real deep understanding of God. You know, and so that's a very common thing. I'll do a quick jump back to my early days in IBM that I did not think was significant until recently. I had an older gentleman who noticed my success and the way that I was approaching success, who he said, "Bruce, you're doing great, but there's something that I want you to listen to." And he handed me a beat up case of cassette tapes that were Zig Ziglar tapes.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I know you, you know, I've interviewed Tom Ziglar, you've interviewed Tom Ziglar, and I love Zig. And I enjoyed Zig's teaching about success. And I loved the funny stories that he told. I did not have any faith to speak of then. And so I was a little uncomfortable about the way Zig talked about God and stuff like that. But I loved his funny stories and his Yazoo City accent. But I really thought at the time, you know what, this is cute. This is all fun and good, but it's just a little hokey for me. Okay. Yeah. And I just sort of set it aside. And, you know, so that was in my early 20s. And I just put Zig Ziglar aside for a while and thought I had completely forgotten about Zig. When I was 40 years old, we gave birth to our third child, our second son. I was at a place where I was just totally spent. I was exhausted. I was done. Nothing I seemed to do was going right. I had just filed bankruptcy again after realizing there was no way I could dig out from the mountain of medical debt that we had from our daughter 3 years ago. And so I was done. And so when I was 42, this was 2005, my older brother, who lived in Durham, North Carolina at the time, he came up to Richmond to run the Richmond Marathon. And I was certainly not a runner. I was completely out of shape. I had given up running, had not run again since I was in high school. And so again, probably the voice of that coach came back, and So I completely gave up running. I was not a fat person by any chance. I'm a small bodied guy, but I was carrying more weight than I needed to, but I was so out of weight. I could not ride bikes or play with my kids in the yard for more than 15 minutes before having to sit down and say, wait a minute, daddy needs to catch his breath. But my older brother came to town and he ran the Richmond Marathon and stayed with us that evening. And he said something to me that changed my life. And now my brother did not realize that he was a motivational speaker and he didn't intend to say anything life changing to me. But he said, Bruce, you should do this. And I said, I should do what? He said, you should run a marathon. And I laughed at the man. And I said, you have got to be kidding me. I haven't run since we were in high school. I work from home, and I live in a community where everything I need is within a 5-minute drive. Right. Everything I want is within a 10 or 20 minute drive. So I don't even like to drive 26.2 miles unless I'm going on vacation. Yeah. So I, you know, and he said, I understand all of that. He said, and I said, yeah, I just don't think I can do it. And he said, Bruce, the hardest part about running a marathon is making the decision to do it. Mm. And I was like, yeah, sure, right. And I did not believe him. And he went on his merry way. And I went to my life. I was at that point. I had, you know, the few friends that I still had left. They called me Eeyore from the Winnie the Pooh series. I was grumpy. I was pessimistic. I was absolutely convinced that God was out to make me suffer, that I was total victim mode. I blamed everybody for the situation that I was in. I blamed the then not great economy for my inability to get anything going again. I blamed, you know, the medical community for charging way too much for stuff. Mm-hmm. Everything, you know, if my wife didn't have schizophrenia, if my daughter hadn't died, if, you know, what, all of these things, I blamed everybody. And so that's where I was when my brother said those words to me. I hated my life, Todd. And I literally was at a point where I knew that I hated my life. And at 42 years old, I was thinking to myself, my God, if this is what the rest of, if I'm going to live to be 80 and I've got to go through another 42 years like this, I am seriously going to spend some time studying some bridge overpasses and or tall buildings, because I can't do this another 40 years. No way. And so my brother said, the hardest part about running a marathon is making the decision to do it. I did not believe him. And so over the next couple of weeks, that gnawed at me. And I did start to think that, you know what, if my older brother can run marathons, I can at least join a gym and get in shape, so I can at least hang out and do some fun things with my boys. Mm-hmm. And so I joined the YMCA, and I started, it's winter now, and so I'm not running outside because I'm not going to do anything that's even remotely inconvenient, right? Yeah, I'm a creature of comfort. I want everything handed to me at this point in my life. And so I did at least have a goal of being able to jog, and that's using the term loosely, but to jog 1 mile without walking. And it took me well over a month of going to the gym a couple times a week to hit that treadmill, and it just seemed like I would never be able to jog a mile without walking. But the day I did, something snapped in me. And within a week, I was able to run 2 miles. And, you know, a couple weeks after that, I was approaching, you know, being able to run 3 miles on the treadmill without walking. By this time, it's starting to get a little springish. The spring of 2006. And so our neighborhood had a local 5K, and I enrolled in that. And while I did walk a little bit during that 5K, there was a change that was happening in me. And a month or so later, I enrolled in a 10K. And at that point, I was really starting to enjoy running again. And I decided I wasn't even going to mess with a half marathon. I just decided I would take my brother's advice and make the decision to train for a marathon. And I did. And in November of 2006, exactly 1 year later from when my brother came back, but a little less than a year from when I started running, I ran the Richmond Marathon with my brother, and I beat him by over 45 minutes. But it was, and I mean this very literally, Todd, running saved my life because I was seriously considering suicide because I hated everything about my life. But see, here's the deal about running. You can accidentally run a mile, right? You know, I guess maybe if something was chasing you, you could run a mile. You can muster up. In fact, my son did this, but you can muster up enough bravado or whatever to run a 5K, even if you've never run before in your life. You might could even get through a 10K, but you can't accidentally run a marathon.
Yeah, that's right.
Go ahead.
I want to ask you that. You know, when you made that decision, did that happen in one fell swoop? Did you write that down? Did you put it on your mirror? Did you tell somebody, I'm going to go to the gym? Or did, because you're describing kind of the snowball effect and how making that one decision and making a movement that you did it. Did you write it down?
I did not write it down. I did tell some of my friends that, you know, when I ran the 10K, I said, I'm going to run a marathon and I'm going to run it this year. And it was during the training of, it was during that summer of 2006 that I really started to come to terms with some things. And it was while I was running that I realized that there's no way I can run this marathon unless my brain tells my body to do it. And so I was able to do that. And somewhere in the, I don't remember the day, but it was out during one of my long runs. I actually stopped in the middle of a, you know, somewhat deserted road. I was out in, you know, out in, way out in the suburbs. And I came to a complete stop because I had a realization. And I came back to the teachings of Zig Ziglar, we forgotten 20 plus years before that. And I realized that Bruce did not have financial problems. Bruce did not have marriage problems. Bruce did not have self-esteem. Well, yeah, I did have that, but I didn't have, you know, all of these things that I thought were the problems, that if I could get a job that I liked, if I get my income back up, that I would be a happy person. Bruce had a thinking problem. That's what it boiled down to. And that if I could apply the same principles of mental discipline that it was taking to train my body, if I could start to apply those principles to the rest of the areas of my life, then maybe I could turn my life around. And I was willing to experiment with that. And so somewhere along the line, Wayne Dyer had not written the book, but I had heard somebody about, you know, because I'd have to go back and look and see when Wayne Dyer wrote Change Your Thoughts, Change Your Life. But I had heard that, you know, you can change your thoughts. You can change your life simply by changing your thoughts. So I decided to try it. And so I started to apply, recognizing that I had such negative self-talk. I was beating myself up over everything. And so I started catching myself. And like where I was trying to run, you can't run a marathon if you have negative self-talk, if you're constantly criticizing yourself. You've got to learn how to coach yourself. And so where I stopped, I started to catch myself being a critic And I started thinking to myself, you know what, Bruce, it does no good for you to talk to yourself that way. You know, so how about we try a different way of thinking about this, or at least talking? And so I started, it was also during that summer, again, there are no accidents, that our church held a Dave Ramsey Financial Peace University class. And I had never even heard of Dave Ramsey, but I knew I needed some financial peace, brother. So I went to the class, and Dave Ramsey talked about that. He said, you know, happen to your life instead of letting life happen to you. And, you know, the only reason that you have a money problem is because you're not paying any attention to where your money's going. And that was so me. I was not living on a budget. Whatever was coming in just got spent on whatever we needed to, or whatever we wanted to spend it on. And so I started to take care of that, but then really starting to get into, you know, why does Bruce, you know, why does Bruce beat Bruce up so much? And so that really was the transformative part of my life. And so I started doing things like keeping a gratitude journal. I'd wake up every single morning, and I forget who it was. Maybe it was Jack Canfield who said to work this into your practice. But I've read so many books. They all sort of merge together now. But somewhere along the line, later, you know, so probably around 2007, I started really diving into personal development. And so I started keeping a gratitude journal. And when I started doing it, I did it with absolute insincerity, because I was not thankful for anything. So I wrote, you know, I really thought that, it's happy people who are thankful for the things that make them happy. And so this idea that it's not happy people who are, this idea that thankful people are happy really challenged me. And so I decided to, again, try it. And so I started writing down every single morning. I committed to the discipline of writing down five things for which I was thankful. And in the beginning, I wrote stupid stuff like, I'm thankful for mini wheats, and a chair to sit on, and a cup of coffee. And I wrote them down, but I wasn't thankful for them. But I did it every day. And, you know, it was I struggled to find five things. But over the course of a month or so, I started to notice something was changing in me. And I was still writing down things like mini wheats, and a cup of coffee, and a chair to sit on. And every now and then, my boys would sneak in there. And, but what was happening was I was really thankful for mini wheats, because if I woke up tomorrow morning and I didn't have breakfast, I'd miss it. And so a profound change was really starting to come over me. And, you know, I really shifted into becoming a grateful person. So around those times, things like my business started to pick up again. And, you know, my world really did start to turn around, and I attribute it to changing the way I was thinking about myself. And then the big change happened, gosh, it was 2011, I believe, that I wouldn't even say a friend, an acquaintance. We ran into each other, you know, maybe three or four times a year at social gatherings. But I had known this guy for easily 10 years, pulled me aside at an event once, I believe it was one of our boys' sporting events. And he said, there's something different about you, Bruce, and I want to know what it is. Mm-hmm. And so I started to tell him a little bit about what was going on in my life. He said, I want you to be my life coach. He says, because whatever it is that has happened in your life, I want that in my life. And I want you to teach me how to do it. Todd, I had never even heard the phrase life coach before. I said, what in the world is a life coach? And so he explained that to me. I said, that really sort of sounds like a combination between a best friend and a counselor. And I said, so, we can grab a cup of coffee every now and then. He said, no, I want to pay you. And I want to do this on a weekly basis. And I was like, no. He said, no, I insist. I'm going to pay you. and you're going to tell me everything that you did, and you're going to tell me what I should be doing. And it just snowballed from there. And he referred me to two friends of his, one of whom lives in Philadelphia, and another one who lived in New York. And I started talking with those guys over Skype, and they referred me to people. And I had no intention of becoming a life coach, but it all sort of came crashing full circle as to what I was doing in high school with my friends. And then interrupt me.
I did again. Sorry about that. Well, kind of sorry. It's so cool listening to you. I'm like here just smiling, like captured, you know, there's so many things I want to ask you or mention. It's, you know, it did come full circle, but it started because you took the action. And, you know, you're talking about that. You got up and you went to the gym. You know, there's a person I know for years, and they always said, move a muscle, change a thought, move a muscle, change a thought. Yeah. And I'm thinking, yeah, whatever, you know, and just listening to you describe what has been happening to you in the transition, especially in the early part of the transition, that's exactly what happened. But also I wanted to mention, you use the word discipline, and that word sometimes makes me or other people shudder a little bit. It seems like there's a sacrifice there. Like this is going to stink. This is going to be hard and it's boring and rigid and all that. And really listening to you describe your story, that's what happened to you. You did the work. You've been doing the work. And then the changes came. You participated in the change.
You know, and I did do the work, and the discipline in the beginning was no fun. Discipline is not fun. It's not, you know, it just isn't. But I had a really big why. I hated my life so much that I was willing to take it, and I did not want to. I wanted to live, and I wanted to have an amazing life. So it was really my last straw. It was like, I'm going to try this. And if this doesn't work, then I don't know what I'll do. But I was, you know, I had a pretty significant why. And then what year is this? So in 2012, I woke up in the middle of the night from a nightmare. And my nightmare was this. I was back in college. And it was about a month before I graduated from college, and I was sitting in my writing professor, Dr. Richard McCann. I was sitting in his office. He had called me in, and he called me in because he wanted to talk to me. And he said, Bruce, I'm worried about you. He said, I think this computer thing is going to be a major distraction from you, and it's going to cause you to not pursue what you were meant to do. And I was 20 years old. I said, you know, and I had already had the job offer with IBM. And so what does the 22-year-old guy who's got a solid job offer say to a college professor who wants him to be a starving writer? I said, you know, I appreciate it, but it's not going to do that. I've got this. I'm good. I convinced myself that the money was going to be able to fund my ongoing writing career. So here's the deal. When I woke up from that nightmare, I sat straight up in my bed. And so easily, I was 22. So at this point, I'm 45 years old. During the last 23 years of my life, I had completely forgotten that I ever wanted to be a writer. I started writing again. And, you know, so between the, you know, starting to write again and starting to get into develop a life coaching practice, my world really did. I really do feel that I am now doing what I was created to do from the very beginning. And all of those, you know, there are no mistakes. There are no failures. All of the tragedies that have happened to me in my life have all led me beautifully to this place in my life where my story, where, you know, I've learned that sometimes the the pain that we go through in our lives is a gift.
Mm-hmm.
And we're never given a gift for our own personal benefit. We're given gifts so that we use them to turn around and use that to be a gift, be a blessing to other people.
And you know, Bruce, I listened to your story, Bruce, and it just seems that way. It took 23 years for you to kind of shift back, but some days more, some guys it's longer than that, some people not so long, but wild. It just seems to me like you're describing is that the resistance is what really causes the discomfort. You know, that's the resistance piece, the resistance to not doing what I'm created to do. And that's so sometimes I think that, like you're talking about, the pain or that the discomfort is a gift. It really is. It keeps us moving in a direction. You had to hit a bottom of, I want to take my life. Then most of us need to hit some sort of hopelessness to go a different direction. Yeah. And you're describing it as well. It's just wild to listen to the stories time and time again.
You have had him on your show multiple times. But Don Miguel Ruiz's book was an epiphany to me because he put into words everything that I knew in my heart. And I was just talking with my 18-year-old. You know, who is it that says most men live lives of quiet desperation?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know who said that. But what that describes, the quiet desperation that most of us live is this inner angst, this inner misery that we are not doing what we were created to be because we've given in to the domestication that Don Miguel Ruiz talks about in the Four Agreements, that you know society wants to domesticate us so that we are just like everybody else. And so we're easy to control, that you know, and so that's what we give in to it because it's sometimes just easier to fit in than it is to resist the domestication. And that's what, you know, I just got to this point where I couldn't, it was making me miserable. I wasn't aware of what it was, but that misery inside me and, you know, the failures were, I really do believe God saying, Bruce, I don't want you to make money the way everybody else is making money. I don't want you to have the same values of what happiness is, what success looks like, that the world, that Hollywood, that, you know, modern American TV, the world that success and happiness is supposed to be. And so I'm going to break you. And I'm going to give you these pains. And so I'm going to take your daughter away from you. And it's now what I realize is the phrase actually comes from a song from a band called Sixpence and I'm the Richer. But the line is, it's the gift of a holy loss is what it is. It's a burning of the dross. And so... So about the time that you take this is your show, but I can go on for a long time.
You're doing great, man, and I'm loving it, Bruce. Really, there's so much value and so much information in your experience. I failed to mention earlier for the listeners that anybody that wants to know more about you can go to brucevanhorn.com. That's the best website to reach you. From there, I'm sure they can get to your social platforms as well. Is that correct?
Exactly. Yeah. BruceVanHorn.com. And, you know, I talk about this pretty much every day on my podcast called Life is a Marathon.
Yeah. I didn't mention that either. I apologize. You're a podcast as well. You have a hugely successful podcast, Life is a Marathon. Where can they find that? Right off the website?
LifeIsAMarathon.com. It's all, you know, BruceVanHorn.com is the hub. You can get to everything from there. iTunes, Stitcher, just search for Life is a Marathon or Bruce Van Horn.
You know, you're a great guest. You're, no offense, but you're easy. I don't have to say much. You know what I mean? You just come out, and that's what I know. I really appreciate that. Some of my what I feel are the very best informative shows are when I really don't have to say anything at all.
Yeah.
That's good. I'm good with that.
No, it flows. And then you're a wonderful host because you ask the right probing questions to just get me talking. and you do that with all your guests.
Well, I appreciate that. It comes naturally. It's so cool. I have so much to learn, and I've learned so much more than I really signed up for. You know what I mean? Because these guys, you're talking directly to me, and hopefully the listeners get the value as well. But, you know, so you've been talking about so much. I didn't really get a chance to talk to you about your first book or the second. I don't know if Worry No More was your first book or You Can Go the Distance was your first book. And I want to know what book you're writing now. I got a lot of things I need to know, man.
No, it's fun. So in the midst of writing, so back in 2012, I started writing again, and I didn't really know what to write about, but I was really into marathon running then. So I thought, well, I already owned the domain brucevanhorn.com and never did anything with it. So I started a running blog. And I thought, well, you know what? No one is going to listen to Bruce Van Horn unless Bruce Van Horn is an expert on something, because all of the experts say that you need to be an expert on something. And I said, well, I'm not an expert, but I am a good writer. And so I can sound like an expert. And so I started writing about running, and I tried to hold myself out as an expert. And again, I felt like a total hypocrite, and I was miserable every single blog post I wrote. And I think that in those early days when I was trying to sound like an expert, my mother was the only one who read my blog post. I had no traffic. And so one day I wrote a blog post about how frustrated I was about a particular run, about how I did not feel like getting up that morning, that I really struggled with it. And that post just flowed out of me. In fact, I almost deleted it because it sounded so amateurish. Mm-hmm. And somebody saw that post and shared it with somebody else and shared it with somebody else. And I got more traffic to my website in like a week than I had in almost a year. And that was, again, a voice sort of spoke to me and said, Bruce, I don't want you to be everybody else. I want part of your gift is being vulnerable, sharing how you are not perfect. And so I started writing from the mindset of what it takes to be a marathon runner, and some very successful and well-known runners somehow or another discovered my blog, and guys like Greg McMillan and Bart Yasso and Galloway, you know, these names don't need to mean anything except to other marathon runners. But they really encouraged me to keep writing. And so I wrote a book called You Can Go the Distance, a marathon training guide, but it really is from the mental aspect. And I published that book on my 50th birthday in November of 2013. And it's been awesome. It's been on Amazon's bestseller list ever since I published it. So almost 2 years ago.
Hey, congratulations.
And so
you got something up your sleeve now too, right? What book you got coming out?
Yeah. So I just published last week. In fact, I quietly published it because I'm not going to do a big social media blitz until July 1st on it. But the day I released this book called Worry No More, Four Steps to Stop Worrying and Start Living, the day I released the Kindle version, it hit Amazon's bestseller list.
Nice.
And it's now already an international bestseller list. The paperback, I got a wonderful Father's Day gift. I self-publish everything. And so I put out the paperback version through CreateSpace, and it takes them sometimes about a week to get it integrated into Amazon's system, and they got it done in 3 days. And so they had it undone on a Sunday. So I checked on the afternoon of Father's Day, and there was my paperback. But yeah, this book is called Worry No More, Four Steps to Stop Worrying and Start Living. And in this book, I share so many of the things that we've just talked about, but I was what I thought was at the height of my game, and you know, because I turned my life around, one of the things that I didn't mention is that in the early 2000s, I started a software company. And so this company is almost 14 years old, and I am still a part owner of it. But I've moved pretty much full time into life coaching and writing. And so I'm more of a silent partner in it now. But I was really at the height of my game until February of 2014. And I was, I'd published my book in November of 2013 when I turned 50. And I was a couple months late going to get my 50, you know, my physical health checkup when I turned 50. So I didn't do that until December. And there were some issues there. And so my family physician sent me to my urologist, who did some more blood work, but wasn't quite sure. So we waited another month. And then I had a biopsy done in early February of 2014. And on February 17th, he called me and he said, "Bruce, I did not expect this at all." You know, because first of all, you're 50 years old. And statistically, this just doesn't happen, but you have stage 4 prostate cancer. And you know, so that kicked me on my butt, for a day or two. And then, you know, and that's where I really was able to reap the fruits of the work that I had done. Had I gotten this diagnosis or anything even similar to it when I was in my mid-40s, no doubt what I would have done. But, you know, I needed to move through. And, you know, so how do I deal with, I was also in the midst of a divorce. You know, unfortunately, my wife's schizophrenia took a significant turn for the worse, and she heard voices that told her to kill my boys. And so she had to be removed. And, you know, and so I got, and so we were going through all of that at the same time as I got this cancer diagnosis. And then I had surgery in April, and there was a complication during the surgery. And so I lost 70% of my blood on the operating table during the surgery. And so things were really, really dicey for a while there. And I had some more epiphanies when I was in the hospital recovering from that. And a lot of that is the fruit of this book, Worry No More, which I'm just super proud of it. And I showed it to a couple people who are just heroes of mine, people you've interviewed. So Bob Berg, has, you know, he read the book, and Bob doesn't do book endorsements anymore. And he agreed to read it. And he said, "Bruce, you've got to publish this book and I will endorse it." And, you know, so he wrote it below in review. JB Glossinger is a friend of mine, and he's endorsed the book. John Acuff, Rory Vaden, you know, and so they've all said, "Bruce, you've written a significant work here that has the potential to change the lives of millions of people." Yeah, so I really felt like a lot of the book was—I was just sort of channeling, and I really do believe that, you know, it was just automatic writing.
And it's cool listening to you say that. Even through those, you know, those challenges, you know, to be able to bring those experiences to light and offer those, you know, the solutions and what you've done to others. I mean, that's where it's at, man. That's why. And I've had, you know, Bob's been on the show, Rory's been on the show, JB's been on the show. These guys. They're like lights walking around. Mr. Berg is a huge influence on me.
Oh my goodness.
I mean, he's a hard act to follow, or, you know, he sets the bar extremely high, but he lives what he talks about. And that, you know, I guess that's authentic. Yeah. That's that authenticity piece we hear so much about, you know, so you're around, you got a lot of people around you, and that you are a light, Bruce. So that's why the people came to you in high school. And that's why they're still coming to you now. Right. You just got to sort out all that other stuff and let it go, you know?
Exactly. And I talk about that in the book, that the last of the four steps is called rest in peace. So very punny. The P's is, there are five P's in there, and one of them is perspective. That, very often what we are going through, we only see from, if you lie down and look up at the bottom, if you lie down at the base of an oak tree and look up, you see, an oak tree. But the very same oak tree looks completely different from the air. The tree hasn't changed, just your perspective has. And so in the midst of a crisis, I have learned to stop demanding answers from God because God doesn't give them. He never said he would give us. So I ask for a different perspective to see my life from that my life is not usually what I perceive it, that I'm just a piece of a much bigger puzzle, a mosaic, if you will. And so then we also have to trust that our lives follow a plan, I can look back over my life and see the things that happened followed a plan, but a plan is worthless unless there's a why, right? I can tell my boys what we're going to do or what they need to do, but unless I lay out the purpose for them, they're not going to do it wholeheartedly. And so to trust that our lives are following a plan, that the plan has a purpose, and that that purpose is created by our Creator who created it. And our Creator is perfect. And so therefore the plan and the purpose must be perfect. And so therefore all of the things that we would call mistakes or failures in our lives were nothing but that. Your life, Todd, is perfect. My life is perfect. Now we might not think that, but from the perspective of our Creator, who created us according to a perfect plan and purpose, our lives are exactly what they were meant to be. And when you can wrap your brain around that, the last of the P's is peace. You can find peace. And my favorite part of the book is the four steps to stop worrying and then start living. Mm-hmm. When you really can't truly live unless you have peace in your heart. But once you do, and my goodness, the opportunities out there are astounding. And so this is what I believe the gift has been to me, to have experienced these things, to be able to share, to lift other people up, because there's a lot of people hurting out there.
Yeah. Well, and Bruce, you've done that.
And I know where they are.
Well, you've done that for us tonight too. You certainly lift me up, and I'm sure all the listeners and the people that are going to be listening to this. I mean, we just really appreciate you and your story and your candor, your open honestness, your enthusiasm. It's just a joy listening to you. There's a lot of people I'm sure going to be put in front of you down the road and continue to help. So, I mean, what you're doing is just a great, I really appreciate you, Bruce.
I appreciate you having me. Again, you're all-star cast. I mean, guys like Don Miguel and Jack Canfield and Bob Berg, my goodness. I'm going to cherry pick your guest list for my show.
Yeah. Well, let us know, man. Yeah. Hey, I am an expert. I'm an expert in one thing. I guess I'm an expert in one thing, and that is I keep getting asked the same question, and they tell me that's where your value is, and everybody asks me the same thing. How do you get those amazing people on your show? Well, I can't give away the secret. Well,
you ask the great questions, because Dave Glossinger is a personal friend of mine. I've been a morning coach member for years. And he shared things on your show that I didn't know about him. I thought I knew everything about JB.
It's just cool.
That's
you
probe and you get people to talk about the things they don't normally talk about. So
I'm just interested.
I appreciate you probing and asking me. I haven't talked about high school in years.
Well, I hope you could take away something too. Telling our stories does that as well. It always does for me. Yeah. So. Bruce, it's been a real joy. I mean, it really has been. We're going to stay in contact with you. Thanks, so much for sharing your story and doing the things you've been doing. We really appreciate it.
Well, and the same for you. I appreciate you and what you're doing in the world, Todd. Thank you.
I appreciate it. Have a great night.
All right. Thank you, Todd.
Thank you. There you have it, Mr. Bruce Van Horn. You can get everything you need from Bruce over at brucevanhorn.com. What a guy. We really appreciate him being here. And check out Life is a Marathon, his Life is a Marathon podcast. Thanks, everybody, for listening to the show. We really appreciate it. We certainly wouldn't be doing it without you and without all the really valuable and successful guests we have and all the wisdom that they bring sharing their own experience. Until next time, make it a great day.